You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When we talk about the weak economy in this country, the focus is usually on housing prices, consumer confidence, and which direction the stock market is going. But a very different aspect of American life is also being affected by the financial crisis, our foreign policy. According to Michael Mandelbaum, our mounting domestic economic obligations will eventually narrow the scope of what American power can accomplish overseas. Mr. Mandelbaum is the Christian A. Herter Professor and Director of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. His book is called The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era, published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Glad to be with you and your listeners.
The United States has experienced a number of recessions since the end of World War II. Why do you think this particular economic downturn is going to have an impact on the way that we conduct our foreign policy, or have they all had some kind of impact?
Well, whenever there's a recession, the country feels pessimistic rather than buoyant and tends to look inward rather than outward. So that has at least a marginal effect on foreign policy. But this time is different for two reasons. First, this downturn is steeper than anything we've really experienced, maybe since the Great Depression. But more importantly, it comes in tandem with a huge wave of obligations the government is going to have to take on as the baby boom generation retires. That is the Americans born between 1946 and 1964. They will be collecting Social Security and Medicare. I should say we will be collecting Social Security and Medicare, and that means that the bill for the federal government is going to go sky high.
But isn't one of the reasons for the downturn our exercise of our foreign policy might? I mean, we're involved in two wars, among other things, and we have our military spread all over the world.
We are involved in two wars, and they are not cheap, and they've been put off budget, but ultimately we have to pay for them. But would that it were true that just by ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we could solve our fiscal problems. We cannot. These wars are expensive, especially Iraq, but the cost of paying Medicare and Social Security for the boomers is much, much higher. I say in the book that I believe that we are not going to engage in military missions like Iraq and Afghanistan because we can't afford them, and I believe that we will cut the defense budget, but unfortunately, that's only going to get us part of the way there.
The national debt has nearly doubled over the past 10 years, going from $5.6 trillion in 2001 to over $9 trillion today. We've also been running huge budget deficits for a long, long time. Is it just that we can no longer afford a global military presence?
Well, we cannot afford what we're doing in conjunction with all the domestic things that we are committed to do, and given the fact that we're not willing to pay taxes for what we spend. So something's got to give, and I believe really everything is going to give. I think taxes are going to go up. Benefits are going to go down, and in those circumstances, people are going to be very cautious about financing foreign policy.
Is that likely? The midterms, most of the predictions are that people who are running against taxes are going to be elected.
Well, if people who are running against taxes are elected and continue to vote against taxes, we'll only dig our fiscal hole deeper. I think the problem with the Tea Party movement is that while it is certainly true that government spends too much, if you define appropriate government expenditure as that amount for which the public is willing to pay, we're spending far more than we're willing to pay. As far as I can tell, nobody in the Tea Party tells us what they're proposing to cut, but ultimately things will have to be cut.
Well, the Great Depression led to a nativist sense in this country, and we became an isolationist country for a while. And then world events forced us to get engaged, World War II. Does this really matter in the end? We could probably become an isolationist country again to some degree, although never the way we were in the past. But then we're going to have to deal with things like 9/11.
Well, that's an important point, and it is one of the major themes of the frugal superpower. The last time we went through the economic meat grinder in the 1930s, the United States didn't play much of a role in the world. Today, we are almost everywhere, and as I argue in the book, in most places, not everywhere, but in most places, we play a very positive, constructive role. We underwrite global peace and prosperity, and so if and as the United States pulls back from the world, that does put global peace and prosperity in some jeopardy.
We're not wanted in many of the places where we are.
We're not wanted in some places, but one of the points I make in the book, and which I believe, is that we are appreciated even by governments that don't like one or another of our policies. And the evidence for that is that although people love to complain about the United States, and why should they be different? We Americans complain about the United States. They don't actually do anything to try to evict us from their neighborhoods.
Well, in Japan right now, that has been a major political hot potato, hasn't it?
It has been. It is. It's a hot potato in Korea. It's a hot potato in many places. But when these issues come up, these countries almost always decide that they're better off with the United States for all the drawbacks. And that's especially true in Asia, where they're concerned about a rising China and like to have us around as a kind of insurance.
My guest is Michael Mandelbaum. His book, The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. One of the main complaints of the Tea Party is the health care reform bill. Wasn't part of the point of having it passed that it would bring down health costs, including finding savings in Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, certainly it is an urgent priority for us as a country to bring down health care costs because we pay, you know, twice as much as other industrialized countries for the same general outcomes. Whether this health care reform will do that, I think we don't know. I doubt that even if it enjoys some success in reducing costs, that it will be enough. And, you know, one of the problems we have with health care is one of the problems we have in general with our budget, and that is reform, serious reform, involves taking things away from people, and we don't want to do that, and it's hard to do. But I think in the decade and decades ahead, everybody is going to have to give up some things, and that includes people carrying out foreign policy.
Well, many conservatives are saying, yeah, we don't want to weaken our national defense, but we're happy to get rid of Social Security, the Department of Education, and pretty much everything else that costs money.
Well, I think there's only one thing standing in the way of that policy, and that one thing is democracy in America. The American public is not going to permit the abolition of Social Security or the Department of Education. And I think it's also the case, no matter what the Tea Party says and no matter what we all feel, I don't think it's the case that we will never raise taxes. Taxes are going up, and ultimately not just for rich people, for all of us.
And I'm assuming also that we will tweak some of these programs, like raising the retirement age.
I believe that that will happen sooner rather than later. I believe that that's a good thing. But one of the points I make in The Frugal Superpower is when that happens, people are going to say to themselves, do we really want to pay for protecting rich countries such as Japan that are not under direct threat when we get less in the way of Medicare and Social Security? So I think it will those necessary and, I believe, inevitable corrections will affect our foreign policy.
Well, we see the same kinds of arguments when we talk about programs like NASA. People say, why should we be sending a rocket ship to Mars when we have a growing poverty rate in the United States?
Well, and it's a good question, and there are lots of good questions that cannot be avoided once the country decides that it has to cut back, once we decide or conclude, as I believe, that we're going to have to pay our bills.
Because there seems to be a kind of cognitive dissonance on the part of the American public. We want things that the government provides, like Social Security, Medicare, et cetera. And we want a democratic Iraq, and we want peace on earth, but we don't want to pay for anything.
Everybody wants to go to heaven, and no one wants to die. But ultimately, we'll have to pay the bills. We've been able to carry on this way because we've been able to borrow money, but that won't go on forever.
But the United States debt as a portion of the GDP is still not as high as it was in 1945.
It's not as high as it was in 1945 when it was higher, but it's heading in that direction. And in 1945, we did not have the expensive entitlement programs that we're going to have to pay for. And in 1945, and for a couple of decades, we had 4 to 5% growth, and no economist that I know of thinks that we could do that.
In 1945, we entered a period of a serious economic boom.
And
nobody's predicting anything like that. In fact, if anything, even under the best circumstances, we'll go into a gradual decline.
When people say to me, I don't agree with your thesis, I don't agree that we're going to face these stringencies, I don't agree that we're going to have to make these tough choices, I say, I hope you're right. Because in order for you to be right, we will have to have the kind of boom we had in the two decades after 1945, after World War II. And that would be terrific, but I wouldn't count on it.
Well, one of the arguments the president had for putting more money into infrastructure and all of that is that we stopped investing in it over the past 30 years. Is there a case to be made for programs that will help narrow that will provide jobs?
There is a very powerful case, I believe, for modernizing our infrastructure and for investing in education, because that's what economic growth is based on. But that makes the fiscal future even harder, because it means that not only do we have to cut back on things, but we have to spend on some things. We've got to spend more on infrastructure than we are now. So that makes our fiscal problem even greater, and that will put even more pressure on American foreign policy.
Well, the phrase, the title of your book, Frugal Superpower, sounds like an oxymoron.
So far, it has been, and the great question, not only for the United States and not only for American foreign policy, but I believe for the world, is whether we can pull it off, whether we can be both frugal and a superpower.
Now, often people talk about NASA and foreign aid as luxuries, but aren't they a very small part of our actual budget?
They're tiny. They're a rounding error. And as a matter of fact, even the defense budget isn't all that big a part of our budget now.
Even though it's doubled over the last couple of decades?
And even though we spend more on defense than the next 20 countries combined, but actually defense spending as a proportion of GDP has gone down considerably since the end of the Cold War, the real costs are in our entitlement programs. But and so we cannot get where we need to be fiscally without cutting entitlement programs, but that means that nothing else is going to be spared.
So when politicians complain about earmarks, they're really just looking for the easy answers because the difficult answers are perhaps too difficult for them to push for?
That is exactly right, and I think you've stated very clearly the political core of our problem.
My guest is Michael Mandelbaum, who is the Christian A. Herter Professor and Director of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He has written a book called The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era, published by Public Affairs. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michael Mandelbaum, who is the Christian A. Herter Professor and Director of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. And he's written a book called The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. It's published by Public Affairs. What can a frugal superpower do in the world to affect the kind of change it wants?
Well, the first thing that the United States has to do is become economically healthy. We're not going to be of any use to anyone if we continue along this fiscal path. And that means doing more to balance the budget. And that involves cutting back on a number of things that we do in the world. I believe that the kinds of military missions that the United States has carried out over the last two decades in Bosnia, Somalia, Haiti, Iraq, and Afghanistan, which had different motivations, but all of which ended up in the process of nation building, which is very protracted and costly and frustrating, I think those aren't going to be discontinued. I don't think we're going to see any of that anymore. We're certainly going to see the defense budget cut. And what I hope and what I what I argue in the book is that we will be able to maintain what I regard as the three most important American foreign policies, the American military and political presence in East Asia, Europe, and the Middle East.
What about diplomacy? During the election campaign, Barack Obama was criticized for talking about using more diplomacy and talking to our enemies, and he was criticized roundly. But when he became president, we're not seeing very much of that anyway.
Well, diplomacy is important, but diplomacy—
It's a lot cheaper than sending in troops, isn't it?
It is a lot cheaper, but it tends to be effective when it is backed up by guns and money. People listen to countries that they know can back up their rhetoric if need be, and the more readily you can back it up, the less you have to. The United States is listened to for a whole host of reasons, our democracy, our track record in many parts of the world, but also because we're militarily powerful and rich, and if we're neither, we're not going to be listened to so much.
But hasn't that been undermined to some degree by the sense that we've lost our moral leadership? We've had Guantanamo, torture, Iraq, Abu Ghraib, et cetera, et cetera. That seems to have hurt our credibility to lead the world. And more recently, we've had things like the big debate over whether there can be an Islamic center near Ground Zero. It may be seen one way in this country, but it's seen very differently in the rest of the world.
Well, a lot of things that have happened in this country don't help. But I think sometimes we overrate the amount of attention that people pay to the things that preoccupy us. In Asia, people in Japan and in India, in Vietnam, are primarily worried about China, and they want the United States to be able to support them if China becomes aggressive, and that's what matters to them. So I think all of these controversies that preoccupy us certainly matter, but they may not matter as much as we think.
Well, the global economic crisis has hurt China, hasn't it?
It hurt everybody, but actually China came out better than anybody else and faster because the Chinese government, being an authoritarian government, was able to throw lots of money at the problem. Their stimulus package as a percentage of GDP was much bigger than ours, and they could do whatever they want. So there's a sense in which they're riding pretty high at the moment.
Much has been made about China's quiet quest for resources, including rare earth materials in Africa. Do you think China will increasingly become more assertive in the world stage over the next decade?
That's a hugely important question.
And are they emboldened by what they see as a weakened United States?
Well, you've put your finger on what I think is one of the most important issues in global politics, and I discuss it in The Frugal Superpower. On balance, I'm relatively optimistic that the Chinese won't become ferociously aggressive, that they won't do anything that would start a major war in East Asia because they depend so much on the global economy for trade and investment and for economic growth. And real trouble in that part of the world would upset the global economy and hurt their prospects for economic growth. But as your comment implies, you can't be sure. And it is also true, and you make, I think, a very important point, and I do make it in the book, that the weaker the United States is, the more tempted other countries might be to make trouble.
Haven't we really helped China in many ways when everyone refused to raise taxes to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? We were told to keep shopping, which meant usually for Chinese products, that money then came back to our country in loans from China.
Absolutely right. I think in the long term, the relationship between the United States and China, where they lend us lots of money and we use the money to buy their products, is not healthy even for China, but it's certainly not healthy for the United States. And it's a problem for our foreign policy because we owe so much money to China that it's very difficult to take a firm stand. It's tough to be tough on your banker.
Well, before it adjourned, the House passed a measure that would pave the way for trade sanctions against China, which the United States accuses of keeping its currency artificially low. The Senate is unlikely to go along. How does an undervalued Chinese yuan impact the U.S. economy?
Well, it means that they keep selling stuff to us. We keep buying them. And in order to continue to purchase Chinese goods, we have to borrow money for the Chinese, and we get more and more in debt. And because the Chinese keep their currency artificially low, it hurts our domestic manufacturers and our exporters. And there's a lot of anger in the country, and I think much of it justified. This is a complicated economic question, because there are those who argue that even raising the value of the Chinese currency won't make much difference to jobs in the United States. But one thing that's clear is that as long as we owe the Chinese as much money as we do, it's difficult for us to get tough with them on any issue.
And they have threatened to retaliate.
They certainly have. And I don't think we should assume that they will not.
One of the main areas of concern for the Obama administration at the moment is the likelihood that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. Are we limited in what we can do from military, diplomatic, or economic standpoint on this issue?
Well, I believe, and I say in the Frugal Superpower, that the Iranian threat to the Middle East and to the oil reserves on which the whole world depends is our most serious security problem. And there's no doubt that all of the things that weigh on American foreign policy, including the economic constraints, but also the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, handicap us in confronting Iran.
And it's been argued that Iran is the ultimate winner of the war in Iraq.
Ironically, I think there's a lot to be said for that. Iran's great adversary was Saddam Hussein. We removed him. Their second greatest adversary was the Taliban in Afghanistan. We removed them. And so by eliminating their adversaries, we made the Iranian regime stronger.
My guest is Michael Mandelbaum, whose book, The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Trapped Era, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Every administration I can think of, going all the way back perhaps, to the Kennedys, has tried to resolve the problem in the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians, and nobody seems to have been able to make any real headway. We're seeing some problems right now. But what could we do there, and what kind of impact would resolving it or even creating a more stable situation have on our economic situation?
Well, certainly resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict, which, and I agree with you, that's not imminent, would be helpful, but it would not eliminate what I believe is our chief problem there. As I said, I think that's the Iranian threat, which exists independently of Israel. But I do have one policy proposal in the Frugal Superpower which would improve our position in the Middle East and around the world, and that is we should raise substantially the gasoline tax. That way, we and the world would use less oil, the price of oil would go down, and oil exporters, who seem to be the people who make trouble for us, would have less money to play around with. So, in fact, I argue in the book that raising the gasoline tax to Japanese and European levels, and they pay 2 to 3 times as much for a gallon of gas as we do, is the single most constructive foreign policy initiative that we could take. I have to add that as far as I can tell, there's no political support for this measure. But I do explain in the last chapter of the book why it is so important for us.
I think one of the things we could do is switch to the metric system, because I just recently was in Europe and I really didn't know how much I was paying for gas. I just knew that I was paying a lot of euros for a liter, and I didn't know what that meant. But you say that oil is the enemy of democracy.
It is absolutely the enemy of democracy. For two reasons. One, because it gives dictators a big incentive to stay in power forever so that they can keep getting rich on oil revenue. And two, because it stunts the growth of the kinds of institutions in an economy that are necessary for real prosperity. And those institutions tend to support political democracy. So the best thing we can do for democracy in Russia, for example, is deprive Mr. Putin of his oil revenues. He buys his popularity there by selling oil and gas abroad at high prices.
Well, how do we do that right now? We're selling wheat to Russia. We don't want to lose that. Well, although it's going to drive up bread prices in the United States.
Well, over the long term, if we had a higher gasoline tax, it would do two things. First, there would be conservation. We'd all use less. Second, there would be substitution. Other forms of energy, such as ethanol or electrically powered cars, would become commercially viable. And we could make more rapidly the inevitable transition away from oil.
Well, that's a nice idea, but I predict that you're not going to get too many people in this country and in Congress to support that.
Well, I think you're putting it optimistically. There's no one who supports this. And yet, I believe that we may well have a gasoline tax or an overall energy tax over the next 10 years for fiscal reasons. If and when the consensus changes and people decide that we've got to deal with our budget deficit and that that means raising revenues, then the question becomes not whether we should raise taxes, but which taxes we should raise. And if that's the question, then an energy tax looks not exactly good, but less bad than the other alternatives, such as raising the income tax. So I'm actually rather hopeful over the medium and long term, but for the present, you're right. There's no support for this.
Talking about oil, the Saudi Arabian government recently announced that it was purchasing something like $60 billion in weapons from the United States. It's the largest single arms sale in American history. Do you see that as a move to counter Iranian influence in the region to get back some of our oil dollars?
I think it's both. There's good news and bad news about that purchase. And the good news and bad news is the same. The Saudis aren't going to be able to use these weapons. They can't really defend themselves, which means that they're not going to pose a threat to anybody else. But it also means that as in 19...
Well, why did they want them then?
Well, I think they do it as a favor to us. They like their military to have expensive toys. Maybe they think that they can use them against weak adversaries, but I don't think that that's going to help them much against Iran, all of which is to say that in checking Iran and its ambitions in the Middle East, unfortunately, it does depend on us.
I've had a number of guests who have predicted that the European Union will wind up becoming the next major economic superpower. You don't agree?
No, I wish it were so. I'd like to see Europe more powerful in the world, but Europe has two basic problems. One is that although the Europeans can agree on economic issues, they cannot agree and therefore they cannot act in unison on political and strategic issues. And second, their economic problems are even worse than ours because they are a much more rapidly they have much more rapidly aging societies. So I think that the prospect of a European superpower. Well, as I say in The Frugal Superpower, waiting for the European superpower is like waiting for Godot. Godot never arrives and neither will the European superpower. In my view, unfortunately for us, I think it would be a good thing if there were a European superpower, although it would cause some problems for us. But on balance, it would be good for the world. I just don't think it's going to happen.
So does the United States remain the world's leading superpower simply because nobody else can assume that role?
I believe that that is what's going to happen. I believe that the United States provides the world with some global governance. We provide some, although not all, of the services to the world that governments provide within countries. And because we face a cash-strapped future, we are going to provide fewer of those services, which means that the world will get less governance.
And you're right. The only thing that's worse than an America that is too strong, the world will learn, is an America that's too weak.
Well, that is my unhappy conclusion about what we in the world face in the decades ahead because of our worsening economic position.
So the world loves to hate us, but at the same time, it depends on us.
What I've said elsewhere about the American role in the world as seen by other countries is that three things are certain. They won't praise it. They'll continue to criticize it. They won't pay for it, and they will miss it when it's gone.
And just one more thing. Our defense budget is about $500 billion, and many of the weapon systems that we're paying for these days seem to be totally irrelevant to the current situation. How much of that could we cut? All the aircraft carriers and the anti-missile missiles and all of those other things, and really have much of an impact?
Well, we're going to find out because although the defense—
That's going to happen, you think?
I believe it is going to happen.
But everybody in Congress is going to complain because the company that makes these things is in my district.
We're going to see fierce political battles over the defense budget. But over time, I think that the proponents of reducing defense spending are going to gain the upper hand. That has not been true in the last 20 years, but I think because of our fiscal situation, it will be true. Congressmen will continue to defend expensive weapon systems made in their districts, but I think they're going to run out of ammunition.
Michael Mandelbaum has been writing about foreign policy since, what, 1979? You've been publishing books?
That's right.
12 or 13 books. I don't know which one this is, but the latest is The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.